Chapter 19. Toxicology. Introduction. Every day, each of us comes into contact with things that are potentially poisonous. This is not surprising when you consider that almost any substance may be a poison in certain circumstances. Different doses can turn even a remedy into a poison. Consider a common substance such as aspirin. When taken in recommended doses, it is a safe and effective analgesic. Too much aspirin, however, can result in death. Acute poisoning affects some 5 million children and adults each year. Chronic poisoning, often caused by abuse of medications and other substances, including tobacco and alcohol, is much more common. Fortunately, deaths caused by poisoning are fairly rare. Rates of death as the result of poisoning in children have decreased steadily since the 1960s, when safety caps were introduced for drug bottles and containers. Deaths caused by poisoning in adults, though, have been rising, the majority the result of drug abuse. In this chapter, the term poisoned includes acute and chronic poisonings. As an EMT, you must recognize that patients with either type of problem may have a variety of injuries. Although you cannot stop a chronic substance abuse problem in a patient, you may be able to prevent death caused by the acute effects of a poison. This chapter discusses how to identify a patient who has been poisoned and how to gather clues about the poison. Also described are the different ways in which a poison is introduced into the body. The chapter then discusses the signs, symptoms, and treatment of specific poisons, including sedatives and opioids, medicines with actions similar to morphine. Food poisoning and plant poisoning are also discussed. Identifying the patient and the poison. Toxicology is the study of toxic or poisonous substances. A poison is any substance whose chemical action can damage body structures or impair body function. A poison can be introduced into the body through a variety of means. Poisons act by changing the normal metabolism of cells or by actually destroying them. Poisons may act acutely, as in an overdose of heroin, or chronically, as in years of alcohol or other substance abuse. Substance abuse is the misuse of any substance to produce a desired effect, for example, cocaine intoxication. A common complication of substance abuse is overdose, when a patient takes a toxic dose of a drug. Your primary responsibility to the patient who has been poisoned is to recognize that a poisoning has occurred. Keep in mind that very small amounts of some poisons can cause considerable damage or death. If you have even the slightest suspicion that a patient has taken a poisonous substance, you should notify medical control and begin emergency treatment at once. Discussion of issues relating to suicide is covered in Chapter 20, Psychiatric Emergencies. Symptoms and signs of poisoning or overdose vary according to the specific agent, as shown in Table 19.1. Some poisons cause the pulse to speed up, whereas others cause it to slow down. Some poisons cause the pupils to dilate, while others cause the pupils to constrict. If respiration is depressed or difficult, cyanosis may occur. Some chemical compounds will irritate or burn the skin or mucous membranes, resulting in burning or blistering. The presence of such injuries at the patient's mouth strongly suggests the ingestion, swallowing of a poison such as lye. If possible, consider asking the patient the following questions. What substance did you take? When did you take it or become exposed to it? How much did you ingest? What actions have been taken? How much do you weigh? Try to determine the nature of the poison. Look around the immediate area because objects at the scene may provide clues. An overturned bottle, a needle or syringe, scattered pills, chemicals, even an overturned or damaged plant. The remains of any nearby food or drink may also be important. Place any suspicious material in a plastic bag and take it with you to the hospital along with any containers you find. Containers at the scene can provide critical information. In addition to the name and concentration of the drug, a pill bottle label may list specific ingredients, the number of pills that were originally in the bottle, the name of the manufacturer, and the dose that was prescribed. This information can help emergency department physicians to determine how much has been ingested and what specific treatment may be required. For certain food poisonings, a food container that lists the name and location of the maker or the vendor may be of equal importance in saving the life of the patient and possibly other people. If the patient vomits, examine the contents for pill fragments. Ensure that you are wearing proper personal protective equipment for this activity. Note and document anything unusual that you see. You should try to collect the material, called vomitus, in a separate plastic bag so that it can be analyzed at the hospital. How poisons get into the body. Emergency care for a patient who has been poisoned may include actions on your part that range from reassuring an anxious parent to instituting cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR. Most often, you will not be administering a specific antidote because most poisons do not have one. Therefore, in general, the most important treatment you can perform for a poisoning is diluting and/or physically removing the poisonous agent. How you do this depends on how the poison gets into the patient's body in the first place. Essentially, the four avenues to consider are as follows. Inhalation. Absorption. Surface contact. Ingestion. Injection. Of the four avenues of poisoning, injection often can be the most worrisome one in terms of treatment. In the case of a patient who has inhaled a poison, you can administer oxygen and you can give activated charcoal to a patient who has ingested a poison. In the case of a patient who has contacted a poison, you can flood the skin with water and wash out the patient's eyes. However, when a poison has been injected, it is difficult to remove or dilute the poison, a fact that makes these cases especially urgent. Conversely, all routes of poisoning can be deadly, and each should be thought of as being equally serious. Always consult medical control before you proceed with the treatment of any poisoning victim. Inhaled poisons. Patients who have inhaled poison, including natural gas, sewer gas, certain pesticides, carbon monoxide, chlorine, or other gases, should be moved into fresh air immediately. Depending on how long the patient was exposed, he or she may require supplemental oxygen. Always use self-contained breathing apparatus to protect yourself from poisonous fumes. If you are not specifically trained in the use of this apparatus or do not have appropriately fit-tested equipment available, defer exposure to hazardous environments where inhalational toxins are present to appropriately trained and equipped personnel. Patients may need to be decontaminated by specially trained personnel after they are removed from the toxic environment. The patient's clothing should be removed in this process because it may contain trapped gases that can be released, exposing you to the toxin. You cannot administer emergency care until this step has been completed and there is no danger of the poison contaminating you. Some inhaled poisons, such as carbon monoxide, are odorless and produce severe hypoxia without damaging or even irritating the lungs. Others, such as chlorine, are very irritating to the tissues and cause airway obstruction and pulmonary edema. The patient may have the following signs and symptoms: burning eyes, sore throat, cough, chest pain, hoarseness, wheezing, respiratory distress, dizziness, confusion, headache, or stridor in severe cases. The patient may also have seizures or an altered mental status. Some inhaled agents cause progressive lung damage even after the patient has been removed from direct exposure. The damage may not be evident for several hours. Meanwhile, it may take 2 or 3 days or more of intensive care to reestablish normal lung function. For this reason, all patients who have inhaled poison require immediate transport to an emergency department. Be prepared to use supplemental oxygen via a non-rebreathing mask and/or ventilatory support with a bag mask device if necessary. Make sure a suctioning unit is available in case the patient vomits. As with other poisonings, it is helpful to take the containers, bottles, and labels with you when you transport the patient to the hospital. Often, patients use inhaled poisons to commit suicide. A common technique is for the patient to sit inside a vehicle with the engine running in an enclosed garage. The exhaust fumes from the vehicle contain high levels of carbon monoxide that will cause the patient to lose consciousness and eventually stop breathing. A recent variation on the use of automobiles for suicide involves people using a tightly sealed vehicle as a type of gas chamber. These people mix fairly common household chemicals inside the vehicle to produce hydrogen sulfide gas, which is quickly fatal. When you approach the vehicle and open the door, you may be overcome by the gas as well. If you suspect this type of scenario has taken place, contact hazardous materials responders and have them remove the victim. Absorbed and surface contact poisons. Poisons that come in contact with the surface of the body can affect the patient in many ways. Many corrosive substances will damage the skin, mucous membranes, or eyes, causing chemical burns, telltale rashes, or lesions. Acids, alkalis, and some petroleum hydrocarbon products are very destructive. Other substances are absorbed into the bloodstream through the skin and have systemic effects, just like medications or drugs taken via the oral or injectable routes. Other substances, such as poison ivy or poison oak, may just cause an itchy rash without being dangerous to the patient's health. It is important, therefore, to distinguish between contact burns and contact absorption. Signs and symptoms of absorbed poisoning include a history of exposure, liquid or powder on a patient's skin, burns, itching, irritation, redness of the skin in light-skinned individuals, or typical odors of the substance. Emergency treatment for a typical contact poisoning includes the following two steps. 1. Avoid contaminating yourself or others. 2. While protecting yourself from exposure, remove the irritating or corrosive substance from the patient as rapidly as possible. Remove all clothing that has been contaminated with poisons or irritating substances. Thoroughly brush off any dry chemicals, flush the skin with running water, and then wash the skin with soap and water. When a large amount of material has been spilled on a patient, flooding the affected part for at least 20 minutes may be the fastest and most effective treatment. If the patient has a chemical agent in the eyes, you should irrigate them quickly and thoroughly, at least 5 to 10 minutes for acid substances and 15 to 20 minutes for alkalis. To avoid contaminating the other eye as you irrigate the affected eye, make sure that the fluid runs from the bridge of the nose outward. This action should be started initially on the scene and continued during transport. Many chemical burns occur in industrial settings, where showers and specific protocols for handling surface burns are available. If you are called to such a scene, trained people usually will be there to assist you. Do not spend time trying to neutralize substances on the skin with additional chemicals. This action may actually be more harmful. Instead, wash the substance off immediately with plenty of water. Obtain material safety data sheets from industrial sites and transport them with the patient if available. The only time you should not irrigate the contact area with water is when a patient has been contaminated with a poison that reacts violently with water, such as phosphorus or elemental sodium. These substances ignite when they come into contact with water. Instead, brush the chemical off the patient, remove contaminated clothing, and apply a dry dressing to the burn area. Be sure to wear appropriate protective gloves and the proper protective clothing. Provide prompt transport to the emergency department for definitive care. En route, continue irrigation and provide oxygen if possible. Ingested poisons. Approximately 80% of all poisoning is by mouth, ingestion. Ingested poisons include liquids, household cleaners, contaminated food, plants, and in most cases, drugs. Ingested poisoning is usually accidental in children and, except for contaminated food, deliberate in adults. Plant poisonings are common among children who like to explore and often bite the leaves of various bushes or shrubs. The signs and symptoms of ingested poisons vary greatly with the type of poison, the age of the patient, and the time that has passed since the ingestion. Small children may respond by crying if the poison is an acid or alkaline, and these types of poisons often cause burns around the mouth. Gastrointestinal pain may be present in some cases, and patients may vomit before or after your arrival. If the patient has an altered mental status, it is urgent that you protect the patient from aspirating if he or she vomits. Other signs and symptoms depend on the substance involved. For example, some poisons may cause cardiac arrhythmias, whereas others may cause seizures. It is important to treat these signs and symptoms and notify the poison center and medical control of the patient's condition. Your goal as an EMT is to rapidly remove as much of the poison as possible from the gastrointestinal tract. For most poisoned patients, this emergency treatment is sufficient until further care can be provided at the emergency department. In the past, syrup of ipecac was used to induce vomiting, but today it is recommended in only a few situations in which the risk of losing consciousness is clearly low. Because syrup of ipecac induces vomiting, people who have ingested substances that may cause diminished alertness over time might vomit and inhale the vomitus into the lungs as they lose consciousness. As a result, syrup of ipecac is usually not carried on ambulances. Today, many EMS systems allow you to carry activated charcoal on the unit. Activated charcoal comes as a suspension that binds to the poison in the stomach and carries it out of the system. Therefore, it is more effective and safer than syrup of ipecac. Because activated charcoal is an inky, messy fluid, you may have to do some coaxing to get the patient to drink it. Try to give it in a covered cup with a straw. Remember, you should never force this or any other liquid into a patient's mouth. Although every poison will result in a specific set of symptoms and signs, you should always immediately assess the airway, breathing, and circulation of every patient who has been poisoned. Many patients have died as a result of problems with the ABCs that might have been managed easily. Be prepared to provide aggressive ventilatory support and CPR to a patient who has ingested an opiate, a sedative, or a barbiturate, each of which can cause depression of the central nervous system, CNS, and slow breathing. Whenever poisoning is involved, you should provide prompt transport to the emergency department. The patient may need intravenous IV support and other treatments that can be given only in the hospital. If you work in a tiered system, ALS backup also may be appropriate because these providers often carry and can administer additional medications and therapies. Injected poisons. Poisoning by injection is usually the result of drug abuse, such as heroin or cocaine. Contrary to the thinking of television detectives, the only other parties who are likely to have injected a patient with poison are insects and animals. Signs and symptoms of poisoning by injection can have a multitude of presentations, including weakness, dizziness, fever, chills, and unresponsiveness, or the patient may be easily excited. In general, injected poisons are impossible to dilute or remove because they are usually absorbed quickly into the body or cause intense local tissue destruction. If you suspect that rapid absorption has occurred, monitor the patient's airway, provide high-flow oxygen, and be alert for nausea and vomiting. Remove rings, watches, and bracelets from areas around the injection site if swelling occurs. Prompt transport to the emergency department is essential. Take all containers, bottles, and labels with the patient to the hospital. Patient assessment. Scene size up. Scene safety. When you have a situation that involves a toxicologic emergency, a well-trained dispatcher is of great value. Dispatchers with an appropriate set of protocols and excellent interrogation skills can obtain important information pertaining to a poisoning call that will help you anticipate the proper protection needed to ensure your safety. The dispatcher may be able to obtain information pertaining to the number of patients involved, whether additional resources are needed, and whether trauma is involved. If this information is not obtained before your arrival, you must take the time to assess the scene thoroughly to ensure your safety and to determine the nature of the illness and any mechanism of injury, the number of patients involved, the need for additional resources, and whether spine stabilization is required. Because of the risk of possible cross-contamination by poisons that can be inhaled, absorbed, ingested, and injected, you must take appropriate standard precautions. Use the appropriate personal protective equipment necessary to avoid being contaminated. Mechanism of injury, nature of illness. Most calls that involve poisoning will include information provided by the dispatcher to indicate the nature of the illness. Other calls may require some detective work on your part to determine if a poisoning has occurred. As you approach the scene, you should look for clues that might indicate the substance and/or poison involved. Ask yourself the following questions. Are there medication bottles lying around the patient and the scene? If so, is there medication missing that might indicate an overdose? Are there alcoholic beverage containers present? Are there syringes or other drug paraphernalia on the scene? Is there an unpleasant or odd odor in the room? If so, is the scene safe? This could be a clue to an inhaled poison, too. Is there a suspicious odor and/or drug paraphernalia present that may indicate the presence of a drug laboratory? Drug laboratories can be very volatile, so ensure scene safety. The location of the patient may help contribute to identifying a possible poisoning, and other clues, such as empty pill bottles or open bottles of cleaners near the patient, may provide further information to help you determine what happened. Keep a constant, observant eye on the surroundings, and keep an open mind when questioning the patient or bystanders to avoid coming to mistaken conclusions. Primary assessment. Form a general impression. To best determine the severity of the patient's condition, first obtain a general impression of the patient, assess his or her level of consciousness, and determine any life threats. With substance abuse and poisonings, do not be fooled into thinking that a conscious, alert, and oriented patient is in stable condition and has no apparent life threats. The patient may have a harmful or even lethal amount of poison in his or her system that has not had time to produce systemic reactions. A primary assessment that reveals a patient with signs of distress and/or altered mental status gives you early confirmation that the poisonous substance is causing systemic reactions. Airway and breathing. Quickly ensure that the patient has an open airway and adequate ventilation. Do not hesitate to begin oxygen therapy for the patient. If the patient is unresponsive to painful stimuli, you need to consider inserting an airway adjunct to ensure an open airway. Have suction available. These patients are susceptible to vomiting. You may also have to assist a patient's ventilations with a bag mask device because some substances act as depressants on the body's systems. As you assess and manage the patient's airway and breathing, you must consider the potential for spinal injury. Spinal precautions in an unresponsive patient must begin when the airway is first opened and be continued when positive pressure ventilations are needed. Circulation. Once the airway and breathing have been assessed and appropriate interventions performed, assess the patient's circulatory status. You will find variations in a patient's circulatory status depending on the substance involved. Assess the pulse and skin condition. Some poisons are stimulants and others are depressants. Some poisons will cause vasoconstriction and others vasodilation. Although bleeding may not be obvious, alterations in consciousness may have contributed to trauma and bleeding. Transport decision. Patients with obvious alterations in the ABCs or patients you have determined have a poor general impression should be considered for immediate transport. A delay on the scene to further assess and treat patients is rarely indicated. Some industrial settings may have specific decontamination stations and antidotes available at the site. The majority of the time, decontamination and antidote administration will have been initiated by the industrial response team before your arrival and should not delay rapid transport. Consider decontamination of the patient before transport, depending on the poison your patient was exposed to. This action is necessary if a patient continues to off-gas or the treating crew has the potential to become exposed in the confined space of the ambulance during transport. Decontamination is especially important when transporting exposed patients in a helicopter. History taking. Investigate chief complaint. After the life threats have been managed during the primary assessment, investigate the chief complaint or history of present illness. You should obtain the patient's medical history. In many situations, this can be performed in the ambulance en route to the hospital. If your patient is responsive and can answer questions, begin with an evaluation of the exposure and the sample history. If the patient is not responsive, attempt to obtain the history from other sources, such as friends or family members. Medical identification jewelry and cards in wallets may also provide information about the patient's medical history. Sample history. In these situations, the sample history guides you in what to focus on as you continue to assess the patient's complaints. The physical examination helps to explain what is happening outside the patient's body, and the vital signs tell you what is happening inside the body. These three assessments are important in that they give you direction in the interventions your patient might need. In addition to the sample history, you should ask the following questions. What is the substance involved? If you know the substance involved, you will be better able to access the appropriate resource, such as the poison center, to determine lethal doses, time before harmful effects begin, effects of the substance at toxic levels, and appropriate interventions. When did the patient ingest or become exposed to the substance? This will let you know if and when the harmful effects will begin. This will also let the emergency physician know what harmful effects can be reversed and which ones cannot because of the length of time the patient has been exposed to the substance. How much did the patient ingest, or what was the level of exposure? With this information, the poison center will be able to inform you whether the patient has had a harmful or lethal dose. Over what period did the patient take the substance? Did the patient take the substance all at once, or over minutes or hours? Has the patient or a bystander performed any intervention on the patient? Has the intervention helped? The patient's or bystander's intervention may cause more complications. The emergency physician will also need to know this information to be able to adjust interventions accordingly. How much does the patient weigh? If activated charcoal is indicated, you will need to determine the dose based on the patient's weight. The antidote or neutralizing agent given by the emergency physician may be based on the patient's weight as well. For the physical examination, assess the affected body systems, giving particular attention to the respiratory and cardiovascular systems. Secondary assessment. The secondary assessment is a more detailed, comprehensive examination of the patient that is used to uncover issues that may have been missed during the primary assessment. In some instances, such as a critically ill patient or a short transport time, you may not have time to conduct a secondary assessment. Physical examinations. Your physical examination should focus on the area of the body involved with the poisoning or the route of exposure. For example, if a person has ingested a poison, inspect the mouth for indications of poisoning. Are there burns from caustic chemicals? Are there plant or pill fragments? If the person's skin came in contact with a poison, is there a rash or burns? How large an area is involved? If a respiratory exposure occurred, auscultate the lungs. Is there good air movement in and out of the lungs? Do you hear any wheezing or crackles? Much of what you should focus on in your physical examination is based on the route of exposure and the particular drug or chemical the patient was exposed to. Take the time to become knowledgeable about the effects of general classes of drugs and chemicals so that you will become familiar with specific and common poisons. Management of the ABCs during the primary assessment is the priority assessment and treatment goal. These interventions take precedence over a thorough physical examination. However, once the ABCs have been addressed and managed, conducting a thorough physical examination will often provide additional information on the exposure the patient experienced. A general review of all body systems may help to identify systemic problems. This review should be performed at a minimum on patients with extensive chemical burns or other significant trauma and on patients who are unresponsive. Vital signs. A complete set of baseline vital signs is an important tool for you to use to determine how your patient is doing. Many poisons have no outward indications of the seriousness of the exposure. Alterations in the level of consciousness, pulse, respirations, blood pressure, and skin are more sensitive indicators that something serious is wrong. Be aware that exposure to carbon monoxide may produce false pulse oximetry readings. Reassessment. The condition of patients exposed to poisons may change suddenly and without warning. You should continually reassess the adequacy of the patient's ABCs. Repeat the vital signs and compare them with the baseline set obtained earlier in your assessment. Evaluate the effectiveness of interventions you have provided. If your assessment has provided necessary information about the poisonous substance, you may be able to anticipate changes in the patient's condition. If the patient has consumed a harmful or lethal dose of a poisonous substance, you must repeat the assessment of vital signs every 5 minutes, or constantly if needed. If the patient is in stable condition and there are no life threats, reassess every 15 minutes. If the poison or the level of exposure, e.g., the number and type of pills taken, is unknown, careful and frequent reassessment is mandatory. Interventions. The treatment you provide for poisoned patients depends a great deal on what they were exposed to, how they were exposed, and other signs and symptoms found in your assessment. Supporting the ABCs is your most important task. Some poisons can be easily diluted or decontaminated before transport or en route to the hospital. Dilute airborne exposures with oxygen. Removed contact exposures with copious amounts of water, unless contraindicated, and consider activated charcoal for ingested poisons. Contact your medical control or a poison center to discuss treatment options for particular poisonings. Communication and documentation. Once you have completed your primary assessment, history taking, and secondary assessment, contact medical control to request necessary interventions. Report to the hospital as much information as you have about the poison or chemical that the patient was exposed to. If a material safety data sheet is immediately available in a work setting, take it with you to the hospital. If it is not immediately available, ask the company to fax it to the receiving hospital while you are en route. This will help to identify and quickly make available specific interventions and potential antidotes. Emergency medical care. First, ensure scene safety by following standard precautions and performing external decontamination. Remove tablets or fragments from the patient's mouth and wash or brush poison from the patient's skin. Treatment focuses on support, assessing and maintaining the patient's ABCs and monitoring the patient's breathing. Provide oxygen to the patient and perform assisted ventilations if necessary. If the patient demonstrates signs and symptoms of shock, position the patient supine with the feet elevated, keep the patient warm, provide the patient with supplemental oxygen, and transport the patient promptly to the nearest appropriate hospital. In some cases, you will give activated charcoal to patients who have ingested poison, if approved by medical control or local protocol. Activated charcoal is not indicated for patients who have ingested an acid, an alkali, or a petroleum product, who have a decreased level of consciousness and cannot protect their airway, or who are unable to swallow. Remember that activated charcoal adsorbs or sticks to many commonly ingested poisons, preventing the toxin, poison, from being absorbed into the body by the stomach or intestines. If local protocol permits, you will likely carry plastic bottles of premixed suspension, each containing up to 50 grams of activated charcoal. Some common trade names for the suspension form are Instachar, Actidose, and Liquichar. The usual dose for an adult or child is 1 gram of activated charcoal per kilogram of body weight. The usual adult dose is 25 to 50 grams, and the usual pediatric dose is 12.5 to 25 grams. Before you give a patient charcoal, obtain approval from medical control. Next, shake the bottle vigorously to mix the suspension. The medication looks like mud, so it is best to cover the outside of the container so that the fluid is not visible, and ask the patient to drink it with a straw. You might need to persuade the patient to drink it, particularly if the patient is a child, but never force it. If the patient takes a long time to drink the mixture, you will have to shake the container frequently to keep the medication mixed. Once the patient has finished, discard the container from which the charcoal was administered. Be sure to record the time when you administered the activated charcoal. The major side effect of ingesting activated charcoal is black stools. If the patient has ingested a poison that causes nausea, he or she may vomit after taking activated charcoal, and the dose will have to be repeated. As you reassess the patient, be prepared for vomiting, nausea, and possible airway problems. Specific poisons. Over time, a person who routinely misuses a substance may need increasing amounts of it to achieve the same result. This is called developing a tolerance to the substance. A person with an addiction has an overwhelming desire or need to continue using the substance, at whatever cost, with a tendency to increase the dose. This does not happen only with the classic drugs of abuse, such as cocaine. Almost any substance can be abused, including laxatives, nasal decongestants, vitamins, and food. The importance of safety awareness and standard precautions in caring for victims of drug abuse cannot be stressed enough. Known drug abusers have a fairly high incidence of serious and undiagnosed infections, including human immunodeficiency virus and hepatitis. These patients, when intoxicated, may bite, spit, hit, or otherwise injure you, causing you to come into contact with their blood and other body fluids. Always be sure to wear appropriate protective equipment. A calm, professional approach on your part can diffuse frightening situations. But keep your safety and that of your team uppermost in mind. Expect the unexpected. And remember, the drug user, not the drug, can pose the greatest threat. Alcohol. The most commonly abused drug in the United States is alcohol. It affects people from all walks of life and kills more than 200,000 people each year. More than 40% of all traffic fatalities or injuries, 67% of murders, and 33% of suicides are related to alcohol, which impairs the capacity to think and function rationally. Alcoholism is one of the greatest national health problems, along with heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Alcohol abuse can result in many long-term effects. The most common effect is liver damage, with estimates that up to 90% of heavy drinkers will develop some level of hepatitis, and 10 to 20% of alcoholics will develop cirrhosis. Other long-term effects include an increased incidence of pancreatitis, development of erosive gastritis, and an increased risk for breast and colorectal cancer. The long-term abuse of alcohol leads to atrophy of the cerebrum, possibly resulting in permanently reduced mental function. Although alcohol is often seen as a substance to promote sexual activity, alcohol actually decreases the ability to respond to sexual stimulation, and long-term use can lead to impotence and sterility. Alcohol is a powerful CNS depressant. It is a sedative, a substance that decreases activity and excitement, and a hypnotic, meaning that it induces sleep. In general, alcohol dulls the sense of awareness, slows reflexes, and reduces reaction time. It may also cause aggressive and inappropriate behavior and lack of coordination. However, a person who appears intoxicated may have other medical problems as well. Look for signs of head trauma, toxic reactions, or uncontrolled diabetes. Severe acute alcohol ingestion may cause hypoglycemia, which may contribute to the symptoms. At the very least, you should assume that all intoxicated patients are experiencing a drug overdose and require a thorough examination by a physician. In most states, such patients cannot legally refuse transport. Alcohol potentiates many other drugs and is commonly not the only drug taken. Over-the-counter drugs, including antihistamines and diet medications, can cause serious problems when combined with alcohol. If a patient exhibits signs of serious CNS depression, you must provide respiratory support. This may be difficult, however, because depression of the respiratory system can also cause emesis, or vomiting. The vomiting may be very forceful or even bloody, hematemesis, because large amounts of alcohol irritate the stomach. Internal bleeding should also be considered if the patient appears to be in shock, hypoperfusion, because blood might not clot effectively in a patient who has a prolonged history of alcohol abuse. A patient in alcohol withdrawal may experience frightening hallucinations or delirium tremens, DTs, a syndrome characterized by restlessness, fever, sweating, disorientation, agitation, and even seizures. These conditions may develop if patients no longer have their daily source of alcohol. Alcoholic hallucinations come and go. A patient with an otherwise fairly clear mental state may see fantastic shapes or figures or hear odd voices. Such auditory and visual hallucinations often precede DTs, which are a much more severe complication. About 1 to 7 days after a person stops drinking or when alcohol consumption levels are decreased suddenly, DTs may develop. Patients may experience one or more of the following signs and symptoms: agitation and restlessness, fever, sweating, tremors, confusion and/or disorientation, delusions and/or hallucinations, seizures. Provide prompt transport after you have completed your assessment and given necessary care. A person who is experiencing hallucinations or DTs is extremely ill. Should seizures develop, treat them as you would any other seizure. The patient should not be restrained, although you must protect him or her from self-injury. Give the patient oxygen and watch carefully for vomiting. Have suction ready. Hypovolemia may develop because of sweating, fluid loss, insufficient fluid intake, or vomiting associated with DTs. If you see signs of hypovolemic shock, elevate the patient's feet slightly, clear the airway, and turn the patient's head to one side to minimize the chance of aspiration during transport. These patients may not respond appropriately to suggestions or conversation. They are often confused and frightened. Therefore, your approach should be calm and relaxed. Reassure the patient and provide emotional support. Opioids. The pain relievers called opioid analgesics are named for the opium in poppy seeds, the origin of heroin, codeine, and morphine. On the list of frequently abused drugs, they have been joined by a number of synthetic opioids with origins in the laboratory. These include meperidine, Demerol, hydromorphone, Dilaudid, propoxyphene, Darvon, oxycodone, Percocet, oxycodone hydrochloride, OxyContin, hydrocodone, Vicodin, and methadone, Dolefine. Most of these drugs have legitimate medical uses. With the exception of heroin, which is illegal in the United States, many addicts have started using many of the opioids with an appropriate medical prescription. These agents are CNS depressants and can cause severe respiratory depression. When administered intravenously, however, they produce a characteristic high or kick. Tolerance develops rapidly, so some users may require massive doses to experience the same high. In general, emergency medical problems related to opioids are caused by respiratory depression, including a decreased volume of inspired air and decreased respirations. These drugs often cause nausea and vomiting and may lead to the development of hypotension. Although seizures are uncommon, they can occur, and an overdose can result in the patient entering a comatose condition. Patients typically appear sedated or unconscious and cyanotic with pinpoint pupils. Whereas all of these signs and symptoms may be present with other drugs, the pinpoint pupils are the most commonly accepted sign of opiate abuse. Treatment includes supporting the airway and breathing. You may try to arouse patients by talking loudly to them or shaking them gently. Always open the airway, give supplemental oxygen, and be prepared for vomiting. You will not be able to do much to adequately address hypotension associated with poor circulation caused by these drugs. However, placing the patient supine with his or her feet elevated may help until advanced help arrives. Many home remedies are believed to reverse the respiratory depression associated with heroin overdose, including applying ice to the groin or forcing milk into the mouth. Do not attempt any of these actions because they are not effective and they frequently complicate the clinical picture. Nevertheless, you should be aware that a patient's friends may have attempted inappropriate methods of resuscitation. The only effective antidote to reverse the symptoms and signs of opioid overdose are certain narcotic antagonists such as naloxone, Narcan. Patients will respond within 2 minutes to naloxone when it is given intravenously. Naloxone is usually administered by paramedics or by physicians at the emergency department. Sedative hypnotic drugs. Barbiturates and benzodiazepines have been part of legitimate medicine for a long time. They are easy to obtain and relatively cheap. People sometimes solicit prescriptions from several physicians for the same hypnotics or a variety of sedative hypnotics. These drugs are CNS depressants and alter the level of consciousness with effects similar to those of alcohol so that the patient may appear drowsy, peaceful, or intoxicated. By themselves, these drugs do not relieve pain, nor do they produce a specific high, although users often take alcohol or an opioid at the same time to boost their effects. In general, these agents are taken by mouth. Occasionally, however, contents of capsules are suspended or dissolved in water and injected to produce a rather sudden state of ease and contentment. Use of IV sedative hypnotic drugs quickly induces tolerance, so the person requires increasingly larger doses. You are less likely to be called on to treat an acute overdose in someone who chronically abuses these drugs. However, you may be called to a scene of an attempted suicide in which the patient has taken large quantities of these drugs. In these situations, patients will have marked respiratory depression and may be in a coma. Sedative hypnotic drugs may also be given to unsuspecting people as a knockout drug, or Mickey Finn. More recently, drugs such as flunitrazepam, Rofinol, have been abused as a date rape drug, causing an unwary person to become sedated and even unconscious. The person later awakens, confused and unable to remember what happened. In general, your treatment of patients who have overdosed with sedative hypnotics and have respiratory depression is to provide airway clearance, ventilatory assistance, and prompt transport. give supplemental oxygen, and be ready to assist ventilation. You may attempt to stimulate the person by speaking loudly or gently shaking him or her. Remember to watch for vomiting. A specific antidote is available for acute benzodiazepine overdose. It is called flumazenil and is given intravenously. Although it will reverse the sedation and respiratory depression of the benzodiazepine sedative hypnotics, it will have no effect on the signs and symptoms of overdose from ethyl alcohol or barbiturates. Almost always, flumazenil is administered in the hospital after a physician's assessment. As multidrug use becomes more common, you may find it increasingly difficult to determine what agents patients have taken. Your best approach is to treat any obvious injuries or illnesses, keeping in mind that drug use may complicate the picture and make full life support necessary. Focus on the ABCs, especially the possibility of airway problems, relaxation of the tongue causing obstruction, vomiting, respiratory depression, and in severe cases, cardiac arrest. Abused inhalants. Many abused inhalants produce several of the same CNS effects as do other sedative hypnotics, but these agents are inhaled instead of ingested or injected. Some of the more common agents include acetone, toluene, xylene, and hexane, which are found in glues, cleaning compounds, paint thinners, and lacquers. Similarly, gasoline and various halogenated hydrocarbons, such as Freon, used as propellants in aerosol sprays, are also abused as inhalants. None of these inhalants are medications. Because they are products that can be bought in hardware stores, they are commonly abused by teenagers seeking an alcohol-like high. The effective dose and the lethal dose are very close, making these extremely dangerous drugs. The low cost and relative availability make them favorites of children and curious experimenters. Unfortunately, this is an often lethal combination. Always use special care in dealing with a patient who may have used inhalants. Effects of inhalants range from mild drowsiness to coma. But unlike most other sedative hypnotics, these agents may often cause seizures. Also, halogenated hydrocarbon solvents can make the heart hypersensitive to the patient's own adrenaline, putting the patient at high risk for sudden cardiac death because of ventricular fibrillation. Even the action of walking may release enough adrenaline to cause a fatal ventricular arrhythmia. You must try to keep such patients from struggling with you or exerting themselves. Give supplemental oxygen and use a stretcher to move the patient. Prompt transport to the hospital is essential. Monitor vital signs en route. Sympathomimetics. Sympathomimetics are CNS stimulants that mimic the effects of the sympathetic fight-or-flight nervous system. These stimulants frequently cause hypertension, tachycardia, and dilated pupils. A stimulant is an agent that produces an excited state. Amphetamine and methamphetamine, ICE, are commonly taken by mouth. They are also injected by drug abusers in many cases. They typically are taken to make the user feel good, improve task performance, suppress appetite, or prevent sleepiness. They may just as easily produce irritability, anxiety, lack of concentration, or seizures. Other common examples include phentermine hydrochloride, an appetite suppressant, and amphetamine sulfate, benzedrine, taken for weight control, narcolepsy, and chronic fatigue syndrome. Caffeine, theophylline, and phenylpropanolamine, a nasal decongestant, are all mild sympathomimetics. So-called designer drugs, such as ecstasy and Eve, are also frequently abused in certain areas of the United States. Sympathomimetic drugs are frequently called uppers. A person using one of these agents may display disorganized behavior, restlessness, and sometimes anxiety or great fear. Paranoia and delusions are common with sympathomimetic abuse. Cocaine, also called coke, crack, crystal, snow, freebase, rock, gold dust, blow, and lady, may be taken in a number of different ways. Classically, it is inhaled into the nose and absorbed through the nasal mucosa, damaging tissue, causing nosebleeds, and ultimately destroying the nasal septum. It can also be injected intravenously or subcutaneously, skin popping. Cocaine can be absorbed through all mucous membranes and even across the skin. In any form, the immediate effects of a given dose last less than an hour. Another method of abusing cocaine is by smoking it. Crack is pure cocaine. It melts at 93 degrees Fahrenheit, 34 degrees Celsius, and vaporizes at a slightly higher temperature. Therefore, crack is easily smoked. In this form, it reaches the capillary network of the lungs and can be absorbed into the body in seconds. The immediate outflow of blood from the heart speeds the drug to the brain, so its effect is felt at once. Smoked crack produces the most rapid means of absorption and, therefore, the most potent effect. Cocaine is one of the most addicting substances known. Its immediate effects include excitement and euphoria. Acute cocaine overdose is a genuine emergency because patients are at high risk for seizures and cardiac arrhythmias. Chronic cocaine abuse may cause hallucinations. Patients with cocaine bugs think that bugs are crawling out of their skin. In caring for patients who have been poisoned with sympathomimetics, be aware that their severe agitation can lead to tachycardia and hypertension. Patients may also be paranoid, putting you and other healthcare providers in danger. Law enforcement officers should be at the scene to restrain the patient if necessary. Do not leave the patient unattended and unmonitored during transport. All of these patients need prompt transport to the emergency department because of the risk of seizures, cardiac arrhythmias, and stroke. You may see blood pressure measurements as high as 250 over 150 millimeters of mercury. Give supplemental oxygen and be ready to provide suctioning. If a patient is already having a seizure, protect him or her against self-injury. Marijuana. The flowering hemp plant, Cannabis sativa, called marijuana, is abused throughout the world. It has been estimated that as many as 20 million people use marijuana daily in the United States. Inhaling marijuana smoke from a cigarette or pipe produces euphoria, relaxation, and drowsiness. It also impairs short-term memory and the capacity to do complex thinking and work. In some people, the euphoria progresses to depression and confusion. An altered perception of time is common, and anxiety and panic can occur. With very high doses, patients experience hallucinations. A person who has been using marijuana rarely needs transport to the hospital. Exceptions may include someone who is hallucinating, very anxious, or paranoid. In these cases, you must reassure the patient and transport the patient with a minimum amount of excitement. However, you should be aware that marijuana is often used as a vehicle to get other drugs into the body. For example, it may be covered with crack or PCP, also known as angel dust. Hallucinogens. Hallucinogens alter a person's sensory perceptions. The classic hallucinogen is lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD. Abuse of another hallucinogen, PCP or angel dust, is relatively uncommon among young adults. Fencyclidine is a dissociative anesthetic that is easily synthesized and highly potent. Its effectiveness by oral, nasal, pulmonary, and intravenous routes makes it easy to add to other street drugs. It is dangerous because it causes severe behavioral changes in which individuals often inflict injury on themselves. All these agents cause visual hallucinations, intensify vision and hearing, and generally separate the user from reality. The user, of course, expects that the altered sensory state will be pleasurable. Often, however, it can be terrifying. At some point, you are bound to encounter patients who are having a bad trip. They usually will be hypertensive, tachycardic, anxious, and probably paranoid. Many hallucinogens have sympathomimetic properties. Indeed, your care for a patient who is having a bad reaction to a hallucinogenic agent is the same as that for a patient who has taken a sympathomimetic. Use a calm, professional manner and provide emotional support. Do not use restraints unless you or the patient is in danger of injury. Follow the guidelines specified by local authorities. These patients may suddenly experience hallucinations or odd perceptions, so you must watch them carefully throughout transport. Never leave a patient who has taken a hallucinogen unattended and unmonitored. Provide a great deal of reassurance and request ALS assistance. Anticholinergic agents. The classic picture of a person who has taken too much of an anticholinergic medication is hot as a hare, blind as a bat, dry as a bone, red as a beet, and mad as a hatter. These are medications that have properties that, among other effects, block the parasympathetic nerves. Common drugs with a significant anticholinergic effect include atropine, diphenhydramine, Benadryl, Jimson weed, and certain tricyclic antidepressants. With the exception of Jimson weed, these medications usually are not abused drugs, but may be taken as an intentional overdose. You will find that it is often difficult to distinguish between an anticholinergic overdose and a sympathomimetic overdose. Both groups of patients may be agitated and tachycardic and have dilated pupils. Once a pure anticholinergic poisoning has been diagnosed, the patient may be treated with physostigmine intravenously by staff in the emergency department, depending on the severity of the situation. As newer, safer antidepressants such as fluoxetine, Prozac, and sertraline, Zoloft, are added to the market, you can expect to see fewer overdoses of tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline, Elavil, and imipramine, Trofrenil. In addition to its anticholinergic effects, a tricyclic antidepressant overdose may cause more serious and life-threatening effects because the medication may block the electrical conduction system in the heart, leading to lethal cardiac arrhythmias. Patients with acute tricyclic antidepressant overdose must be transported immediately to the emergency department. They may go from appearing normal to seizure and death within 30 minutes. The seizures and cardiac arrhythmias caused by a severe tricyclic antidepressant overdose are best treated in the hospital with IV sodium bicarbonate. If you work in a tiered system, you should consider calling for ALS backup when you are en route to the scene. Cholinergic agents. The nerve gases designed for chemical warfare are cholinergic agents. These agents overstimulate normal body functions that are controlled by the parasympathetic nerves, resulting in salivation, mucus secretion, urination, crying, and an abnormal heart rate. You are unlikely to encounter nerve gases. However, you may be called to care for patients who have been exposed to one of the organophosphate insecticides, pesticides, or certain wild mushrooms, which are also cholinergic agents. The signs and symptoms of cholinergic drug poisoning are easy to remember because of the mnemonic dumbbells. D. Defecation. U. Urination. M. Meiosis, constriction of the pupils. B. Bronchorrhea, discharge of mucus from the lungs. E. Emesis. L. Lacrimation, tearing. S. Salivation. Alternatively, you can use the mnemonic sludge. S. Salivation. L. Lacrimation. U. Urination. D. Defecation. G. GI, gastrointestinal irritation. E. Eye constriction, emesis. In poisonings, patients will have excessive amounts of these normal functions and body secretions. In addition, patients may have either bradycardia or tachycardia. The most important consideration in caring for a patient who has been exposed to an organophosphate insecticide or some other cholinergic agent is to avoid exposure yourself. Because these agents may cling to a patient's clothing and skin, decontamination may take priority over immediate transport to the emergency department. Hospital staff or paramedics can use the anticholinergic drug atropine to dry up the patient's secretions. In the meantime, your priorities after decontamination are to decrease the secretions in the mouth and trachea that threaten to suffocate the patient and provide airway support. Depending on your local EMS protocol, this can be treated as a hazardous materials hazmat situation. The military has developed antidotes to nerve gas agents that can be administered if they are available and indicated. The most common of these antidotes are the Mark I kit and the Duodote kit. The indications for these are a known exposure to nerve agents or organophosphates with manifestation of signs and symptoms. The kits consist of an auto-injector of atropine and one of 2-PAM chloride, pralidoxime chloride. The auto-injectors are activated in the outer thigh of the patient. Removal of the patient from the source of the exposure is also critical in these cases. If your service carries these antidote kits, you should receive training on their proper use prior to being cleared to administer them. Miscellaneous drugs. Accidental or intentional overdose with cardiac medications has become common only because there are so many patients who have these medications prescribed for them. Children may ingest these medications at their grandparents' house thinking they are candy. Another common scenario is elderly patients who have forgotten they have already taken their medication and take a second dose. Occasionally, people wanting to commit suicide will take cardiac medications if that is all they have available. The signs and symptoms of cardiac medication overdose depend on the medication ingested. These drugs may cause bleeding, cardiac arrhythmias, unconsciousness, and even cardiac arrest. Most of these medications are very powerful, so contacting the Poison Center as soon as possible is important. It is likely you will be given an order to administer activated charcoal, but make sure to check with the Poison Center first. Although not as common as it was 30 years ago, aspirin poisoning remains a potentially lethal condition. Ingesting too many aspirin tablets, acutely or chronically, may result in nausea, vomiting, hyperventilation, and ringing in the ears. Patients with this problem are frequently anxious, confused, tachypneic, hyperthermic, and in danger of having seizures. They should be transported quickly to the hospital. Overdosing with acetaminophen is also very common, probably because acetaminophen is available in so many different preparations, such as Tylenol. The good news is that acetaminophen is generally not very toxic. A healthy patient could ingest 140 milligrams of acetaminophen for every kilogram of body weight without serious adverse effects. The bad news is that the symptoms of an overdose generally do not appear until it is too late. For example, massive liver failure may not be apparent for a full week. In addition, patients may not provide the information necessary for a correct diagnosis. For this reason, gathering information at the scene is very important. By finding an empty acetaminophen bottle, you may save a patient's life. If given early enough, before liver failure occurs, a specific antidote may prevent liver damage. Be extremely careful in dealing with a child who has ingested a poisonous substance. Although such incidents usually do not lead to death, family members may be distraught, and your professional attitude will help to ease the tension. Remember, however, that a single swallow of some substances can kill a child. Some alcohols, including methyl alcohol and ethylene glycol, are even more toxic than ethyl alcohol, drinking alcohol. Methyl alcohol is found in dry gas products and Sterno. Ethylene glycol is found in some antifreeze products. Both cause a drunken feeling. Left untreated, both will cause severe tachypnea, blindness, methyl alcohol, renal failure, ethylene glycol, and eventually death. Even ethyl alcohol, typical drinking alcohol can stop a patient's breathing if taken in too high a dose or too fast, particularly in children. Although they may be used as a substitute by a chronic alcoholic who is unable to obtain ethyl alcohol, they are more often taken by someone attempting suicide. In either case, immediate transport to the emergency department is essential. Table 19.6 lists the most common fatally ingested poisons. Food poisoning. The term ptomaine poisoning was coined in 1870 to indicate poisoning by a class of chemicals found in rotting food. It is still used today in many news accounts of food poisoning. Food poisoning is almost always caused by eating food that is contaminated by bacteria. The food may appear perfectly good with little or no decay or odor to suggest danger. There are two main types of food poisoning. In one, the organism itself causes the disease. In the other, the organism produces toxins that cause disease. A toxin is a poison or harmful substance produced by bacteria, animals, or plants. One organism that produces direct effects of food poisoning is the Salmonella bacterium. The condition, called salmonellosis, is characterized by severe gastrointestinal symptoms within 72 hours of ingestion, including nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and diarrhea. In addition, patients with salmonellosis may be systemically ill with fever and generalized weakness. Some people are carriers of certain bacteria. Although they may not become ill themselves, they may transmit diseases, particularly if they work in the food services industry. Usually, proper cooking kills bacteria, and proper cleanliness in the kitchen prevents the contamination of uncooked foods. The more common cause of food poisoning is the ingestion of powerful toxins produced by bacteria, often in leftovers. The bacterium, Staphylococcus, a common culprit, is quick to grow and produce toxins in foods that have been prepared in advance and kept too long, even in the refrigerator. Foods prepared with mayonnaise, when left unrefrigerated, are a common vehicle for the development of staphylococcal toxins. Usually, staphylococcal food poisoning results in sudden gastrointestinal symptoms, including nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Although time frames may vary from person to person, these symptoms usually may start within 2 to 3 hours after ingestion or as long as 8 to 12 hours after ingestion. The most severe form of toxin ingestion is botulism. This often fatal disease usually results from eating improperly canned food, in which the spores of Clostridium bacteria have grown and produced a toxin. The symptoms of botulism are neurologic, blurring of vision, weakness, and difficulty in speaking and breathing. Botulism can also cause muscle paralysis and is typically fatal when it reaches the muscles of respiration. Symptoms of botulism may develop as long as 4 days after ingestion or as early as the first 24 hours. In general, you should not try to determine the specific cause of acute gastrointestinal problems. After all, severe vomiting may be a sign of a self-limiting food poisoning, a bowel obstruction requiring surgery, or another poison such as copper, arsenic, zinc, cadmium, scombrotoxin, fish poison, or clytosib or inosib mushrooms. Instead, you should gather as much history as possible from the patient and transport him or her promptly to the hospital. When two or more persons in one group have the same illness, you should take along some of the suspected food. In advanced cases of botulism, you may have to assist ventilation and give basic life support. Plant poisoning. Several thousand cases of poisoning from plants occur each year, some severe. Many household plants are poisonous if ingested. Children have been known to nibble on the leaves. Some poisonous plants cause local irritation of the skin. Others can affect the circulatory system, the gastrointestinal tract, or the CNS. It is impossible for you to memorize every plant and poison, let alone their effects. You can and should do the following. 1. Assess the patient's airway and vital signs. 2. Notify the regional poison center for assistance in identifying the plant. 3. Take the plant to the emergency department. 4. Provide prompt transport. Irritation of the skin and/or mucous membranes is a problem with a common houseplant called Diefenbachia, which resembles elephant ears. When chewed, a single leaf may irritate the lining of the upper airway enough to cause difficulty swallowing, breathing, and speaking. For this reason, Diefenbachia has been called dumb cane. In rare circumstances, the airway may be completely obstructed. Emergency medical treatment of Diefenbachia poisoning includes maintaining an open airway, giving oxygen, and transporting the patient promptly to the hospital for respiratory support. You should continue to assess the patient for airway difficulties throughout transport. If necessary, provide positive pressure ventilation.